Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Julia.
My name is Felicia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
All right, so Lady of Qiaoqiu, Warrior of the South, set in southern China, AD 531. And the summary reads, in 531 AD, a 15-year-old princess of the Hsien tribe in southern China keeps a diary which describes her role as a liaison between her own people and the local Chinese colonists in times of both peace and war. It's written by Lawrence Yip. So our first dude writer of the series.
I was going to say, the dudes finally came for the historical stuff.
I know, right? They finally just, they're like, I need to go and get involved in this.
They're like, wait, this Royal Diaries thing seems like it might be a hot ticket. Better get in on that.
Okay, let's not be...
Okay, I'm not... No, no.
Let's not be...
I don't know this man. I shouldn't be rude about it.
I was going to say, Lawrence Yip seems like a nice man from his very limited social media presence that I was able to find.
I was going to say, but from his very prolific writing credits.
Oh,
yeah. If you look on his Wikipedia page, it's like a bajillion books.
Yeah, no, like the man knows what's up.
He knows his craft.
All right, so I thought that, because let's be real, finding sources about this woman that are not in English and that are still accessible, they were a challenge. Mm-hmm. However, considering that the bulk of our listeners are not from China, they may not be super well-versed in Chinese history. So I thought that we could do a bit of an inverted triangle and start big with the historical context, bit of a timeline, some geopolitics basically, and then we start narrowing down to her as a person, who she was, what she did, and a little bit of her legacy.
Awesome.
Just like for housekeeping, a lot of my information is coming from Mark Edward Lewis's China Between Empires, the Northern and Southern Dynasties, and I found some Chinese sources that were useful, such as a Guangdong History and Tourism blog that had a lot of great information on our gal. There's a lot of trouble trying to find good history about China that's not either clearly China bashing or let's go and look at, this is like the terribleness of modern China, but let's go and look at the amazingness of Imperial China. Like, do we not go and hear what we're saying, fam?
Yeah.
Or it's making claims that I can't really find much of a source to back it up. So, again, we're doing our best.
Yeah. Well, and even in his author's note, he essentially said there's only four chapters about...
Four pages
written about her.
Not even
and
chapters.
And he was like, I had a person translate stuff for me, so if I get anything wrong, might be, but it was translated. So even Lawrence Yip was doing his best when he was writing this book.
Exactly.
So basically, don't come for us. That's all.
Well, we're trying, okay? Normally, at this point in the program, we'd have our, what do you remember about the book? What did you think about the book, etc.? But we're going to be really rocking the remix tonight.
What? This is news to me, folks. Breaking news.
It is breaking news. I mean, listen, at a certain point, like, you got to go and mix up the formula or the baby's going to get bored.
Just wait. People are going to be like, no, I love the formula where you didn't actually summarize the plot, where you were really vague about the book, and then you gave me an info dump.
Well, you know what? Fair. But also... I mean,
hashtag deal with it.
I mean, at the same time, though, like, hold on to your butts for the Mary Queen of Scots episode, because that one is going to be our most experimental one yet.
You know what it is? It's like how you have your first, this is what we're doing, part of season one,
yeah,
a la the first half of season one of Glee. You think you know what you get, and then the second half of season one came out, and you were just like, what is this show even? I don't even know what it's about anymore.
Why do you think I stopped watching Glee after season one? I was like, you know what? I'm in an okay place with this show. I'm just going to let it go. best choice of my life.
I know. That is self-care. Knowing when to stop with certain television shows. I'm just like, Godspeed. God be with you. Goodbye.
I know. I cannot see you for this journey. We cannot go down together, but I hope for the best for you. Oh, it became a dumpster fire for every single
And you're just like,
season.
I have no, I don't even know. It's
yeah,
great.
Exactly.
Continuing back to your remixing.
All right. So the question is, what do you know about China and Chinese history?
Oh, man. This is where it gets embarrassing. So, okay. I'm just going to rattle off a bunch of different stuff in no particular order. And in my order doesn't show the amount of stuff I know on that thing. It's not... The reason why I'm listing this first is because I know the most about it. Mm-hmm. This is literally extemporaneous speaking right now.
Mm-hmm.
China. Okay. Avi, we have Mulan.
Oh my God.
Don't hate. No judgment.
Okay.
I have...
This is a safe-ish place.
This is where I'm being very vulnerable about my ignorance. I have the wonderful show Empress of China starring my fave, Fan Bingbing. Mm-hmm. Most beautiful woman in China, in my opinion. What else do we got? Obviously, we have like the Silk Road. We have the fact that, you know, Chinese people invented fireworks, gunpowder, pasta, paper, writing, in the modern sense of it. Do you know what? Here's the problem. I know more about China in the context of when Europeans showed up and were like, here's our garbage. Do you want to do trade with us? Chinese people laughed at them and said, we invented this 500 years ago. What are you giving us this garbage for? Like, we don't want to trade with you. Let's see what else. Obviously, there's the Ming Dynasty, which is like prolific in terms of when we think of a lot of quintessential high culture and art coming from China. So like
a lot, that's basically like where chinoiserie inspo from.
Well,
there.
And sort of prototypical when you're imagining, you know, ancient China and it's all flowy robes and, you know, beautiful silks and the elaborate hairdos with the gold and the sort of beautiful headdresses and stuff. Chances are that's probably from the Ming Dynasty.
Or so, it was probably, like, a little bit earlier.
Or the Tang. So, yeah, and then, you know, the Great Wall of China and the invasion of the Mongolian people and then, like, that whole thing. And then there was the Marco Polo TV show, which I tried to watch for 3 minutes, and then I was, peace out, I can't handle this.
I just want to say two things. Number one, the Marco Polo show is a lot better than people give it credit for.
Okay.
Number two, I remember when it got canceled and our dad came and was like, I can't believe Marco Polo got canceled. He was deeply upset.
Poor Gary. All his faves keep getting canceled on him.
I know.
He gets into Penny Dreadful finally and then just like pull the plug on him. Like, this is why our father has trust issues. I
know.
Think.
All of his TV shows keep getting
taken
canceled.
away.
Yeah.
Basically, you need to stop introducing him to shows unless you're guaranteed about, do they have a good ending?
Why do you think I'm trying to get him to watch Black Sails, but he keeps on starting and stopping all the time? Like, listen, you just have to get through season one, and then it'll be better. And then I was like, oh, hey, I'm on season four. This is really good. And he's like, how many more seasons? Like, you're on the last season. No!
Well, why do you think I was so reluctant to say, you should check out Peaky Blinders? Because I didn't know where it was going to go.
Fair enough.
So anyways.
Point is,
back to my, well, I was trying to basically do a diversion tactic away from the embarrassment that is my, like, the file folder of China is so thin. Please make it bigger now.
If it makes you feel any better, my knowledge of China is basically about, like, modern Chinese history. So, like, Republic of China, People's Republic of China. That's mostly what I know.
Yeah, and I would say, yeah, in that sort of modern context with the Chinese-American, Chinese-Canadian experience.
So on one hand, being that person who says, let me take you on this journey about a whole nation, its history, isn't like the sole goal. But I do think that having more familiarity with the place that we're talking about is useful. Mm-hmm. I think like also it's because, how long has China been around? Like, China's been around for, like, four freaking ever as a very advanced and very progressive civilization. I think sometimes take a moment to step back and you see what history was running concurrently. And so when China was going and getting basically it, like, civil servants were getting sorted out. They were inventing some of the most amazing inventions of the time, like, beyond just gunpowder, but I mean paper, mass production of ink, silk production. They also had paper money, too, up a lot sooner than the rest of us did.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, that's something to go and keep in mind, too, as well, when we're talking about China. So a lot of the girls that we've talked about so far have been part of nations whose histories are better known within the Western context, slash another part is that their borders and people are a lot more familiar. Within China, like, it's multi-ethnic, it's multilinguistic, it always has been, and it probably always will be. And I think that's one of, like, the assets when we talk of Chinese people. It's not just, like, an ethnic monolith. It's sort of like how when we were talking with Nzinga, like, who are these people? It's like, well, you have, like, various ethnic groups, even within, like, this small geographic region. The same typical thing was happening in China, too. Anywhere in the world, right?
Yeah. Borders aren't as rigid. No. I think that's the biggest thing.
Yeah. You have the people who are nomadic. You have the people who go and stay in, like, one space as well, too. All those types of things. But anyways, Chinese history is divided into three main periods and then further down into either the hereditary dynasty, so it lasts generations, or the modern government systems, so the Republic of China and now the People's Republic of China. We have the ancient period, we have the imperial period, and we have the modern period. When it comes to dynasties, of course, there would be power squabbles or you'd have people uniting, they'd be expanding, all that regular, like, fun dynasty stuff that you would expect. Now, our protagonist, she's actually known as Lady Xian. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm going to do my best with the names, but in the end, like, I'm not going to say them right. You can make fun of me if you want to. It's spelled X-I-A-N, and she was living during two main dynasties, and that's basically known as the Northern and the Southern Dynasty, which ran from 386 AD to 589, and the Su Dynasty. And this dynasty had a bit of overlap. It ran from 581 to 618, and then it was followed by the Tang Dynasty. Just for clarification, within the Northern and Southern dynasties, there was a lot of changing of hands between families. So we have the Northern chunk of dynasties, mm-hmm. and then we have the Southern dynasties, different chunks of people.
Kind of like Upper and Lower Egypt, where there was, like, concurrent kingdoms.
Concurrent kingdoms, but even, like, within there, like, they switched hands.
Oh.
And, like, at one point towards the end of, like, the North and Southern period, you had two dynasties splitting the North and two dynasties splitting the South.
Oh, so splitting within the split of North and South.
Pretty much.
So quartering, essentially.
Roughly. Yeah. Yeah. They divide amongst the geographic regions, and that is immediately following the five dynasties and the Ten Kingdoms period.
Oh.
Yeah. The Tang Dynasty follows immediately after the Su Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go and I'll get more into it. Where did, like, the North and South Dynasty come from? The divide came following a very tumultuous, like, 16 Kingdoms period, where basically, again, like, everybody was fighting everybody. As another example of how proto-Balkanization never really works. Basically, what happened was that there had been the Han Dynasty, which had been in power for almost a century at that point, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, and a long time.
And then it basically imploded, became like these 16 kingdoms, all these fighting, and then they got unified into, like, the North and the South.
Interesting.
Yes.
Because in the back of the book, they were sort of, the Han Dynasty was kind of like the Roman Empire in terms of, like, a great unification.
Mm-hmm.
But then the same way that the Roman Empire, too big to fail, it failed. So yeah. The same thing happened with the Han Dynasty.
Yeah. Pretty much. In terms of, like, specifically with the Southern and Northern dynasties, it's exactly what it sounds like on the tin. It's China being divided between essentially the North and the South. Our main text of the night, which again is Lewis's China Between Empires, in synthesizing what he says, is that there was a second and more important reason for preferring the rubric of North and South, because one of the things he talks about is like, how do you really go and categorize this period of time when you no longer have like the Han dynasty, but it's pre-Su dynasty and then pre-Tang, where it's like hereditary, soul, etc. So the reason why he prefers the rubric of North and South is that major changes associated with this geographical division in many ways define the historical significance of this period. The southward migration of a large percentage of the Han population and the cultural innovations elicited by their encounter with an unfamiliar landscape and distinct peoples led to a divergence of the South from the culture of the North. While the name Northern and Southern Dynasties acknowledges the fact of political division, it also suggests the expansion and diversification of the Chinese cultural sphere during this seminal epoch in the history of Imperial China. This kind of leads me to my Yangtze River interlude, as I'm calling it. So what's the Yangtze River?
Isn't it the biggest river in China?
You're on the right track. The Yangtze River is the longest river in all of Asia. And it's actually the third longest river in the world.
And you can see it from space, I think.
Yeah, it is absolutely massive. We don't have a map in front of us, but so the Yangtze River basically goes and it like dips down and then it goes across and it cuts. The northern part, the north part of that, that's where the Han people were from. That's where like the northern dynasties like emerged from. That's where like, Shanghai is, where Beijing is. All those like lovely people are up there.
Yeah.
And then you go south and then that's where really like the geographic and then the cultural divide is.
Yes.
Well, and another thing, too, is that that's where we go and we have the difference between, like, in the north, you go and you have people speak Mandarin. In the south, that's where you have Cantonese, you have the Hakka language. Like, that's where a lot of the ethnic minorities within China, that's where they live at that point. And even now.
Yeah. Wasn't that something also in the back of the book they were saying for a period of time, like essentially they said they treated the southern part of China almost the same way that Britain treated its colonies?
Yes and no, because there actually was a lot of
natural resources. Yeah.
You have a lot of land. It's very fertile because it rains all the time there.
Yeah, it's like tropical.
One of the things that Lewis goes and it's a really good book because one of the things is that he outlines the geographic differences in the South. You can go and get upwards on a really good year to harvest a food and you can have a bigger variety too of type of produce as well. So it basically was a proto bread basket.
I was going to say it's like the bread basket of China in a way.
Exactly. I know that this is a really like high level information, but I do think that it's always really interesting to go and talk about geography and how it shapes civilizations and how it impacts people and how they encounter each other. It's kind of like even thinking back to Elizabeth I. Why was England the way it was? Well, it was cut off from the rest of Europe.
Yeah, it really got to sort of be in its own petri dish for a lot of different things.
Exactly. Things never happen in a vacuum, and it's not always just the people, but literally like the actual physical environment in which they live in that goes and shapes their choices, what they need, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, by the time that China was reunited by the Su dynasty in 589, it was a very different world. The once peripheral Yangtze had become the breadbasket or rice basket of China, a fact marked by the Su's construction of the first Grand Canal to provision the northern capitals from the produce of southern provinces, the intellectual universe of Chinese elites, and the very language with which they articulated it had changed as well. That elite, defining itself for both genealogy and new literary practices, was incorporated into the state order for its hereditary claims to entry-level posts. At the opposite end of the social spectrum, the hereditary status of tenants and soldiers was also written into the legal order that the Su and Tang dynasties inherited from the preceding centuries. The imperial government, underpinned by a military system derived from a modified, quote-unquote, tribal structure, asserted its transcendence of the mundane civil order, while Buddhism and Taoism, as well as the social space created by their temples and shrines, transformed both the state system of which they were now part and the kin structures in which they played a major role. This new China found itself incorporated into a greater world where it exchanged goods and ideas with states that shared a common Buddhist religion and in some cases a common writing system. In all the ways, the neglected centuries between the Han and Tang left a profound permanent impression on Chinese history. The time in which she was living...
It's almost like the Dark Ages, isn't it?
Except not, though. Mm. Because during that time, I know how you said earlier that when we think about like, the quintessential China and like Xinhua's and all of that.
Yeah.
It's really in this time that how we understand the Chinese writing system really gets established in terms of like the classical era. It's where a lot of what we consider to be prototypical Chinese art goes and gets solidified.
Yeah.
And their literature like output, it becomes like nothing else.
The fashion and the looks, those Empress of China looks probably coming... It's inspired by what it was happening in this period.
Pretty much.
Like, even though it happens way afterwards, that becomes the standard.
That's when it gets codified.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah. But anyways, so that's where our girl is living in and where she's coming out of.
A very chaotic but exciting time.
Exactly. So, within the text, she's known as Red Bird.
She is.
But she's also really known as Lady Xian, and she is a well-regarded figure in Southern Chinese history. We know she existed.
Mm-hmm.
We know that, and there are records of her. There's even a gorgeous temple to her located in Gaozhou in Guangdong province. This temple was moved to its current location during the Ming Dynasty, so the 15th century, but was recently updated within the 21st century.
Oh my gosh. I just laugh because I think about that fabulous YouTuber who likes to explain about Chinese culture in like through the lens of how it's being portrayed in modern Disney movies or something, and how she's saying, you know, this is relatively new. It's from like 1200. You Westerners have no concept of time.
No.
You know, so the Chinese people will be like, oh, it's really not that old. We don't need to preserve it. It's from, you know, 1307. Whereas,
oh my gosh.
You know, Europeans are, no, that's when we finally were getting it together.
So I want to bring up her temple really quickly, at least like so you can go and see the entrance to it.
Ooh, that's beautiful.
What are you saying?
Oh, I'm always bad at describing things. Well, it's a beautiful Chinese temple and it's got wonderful carvings and figures on top of the roof. So it has the sort of dragon scaling roof that you would imagine, but there are also dragon figurines and there's looks like water figurines. And obviously you have the upturned corners, beautiful emerald jade color, lots of nice red wood. So the fact that this temple, the materials and beautiful like stone carved columns and things like that. So the fact that, you know, when you said this temple was made, and even though it's been restored, that is still around. It's remarkable. It's actually a piece of art.
It is.
Yeah.
We will definitely go and share the image too. But yeah, so she is really well regarded.
Yeah. Like when you think about the veneration of people, it's usually, you know, the emperor or the empress or something. So the fact that she's an elite person,
mm-hmm.
but she's not the empress of China.
No.
So... the fact that she's, you know, they made a temple for her, but the fact that they've even thought to preserve it.
Yes.
I think that is really significant.
Well, she's considered to be a very strong example for, like, contemporary Chinese people. At least from what I've read, I could be wrong, but this is what the tourism page from the region told me, and I did my best.
Okay. No worries.
All right. But anyway, so the Chinese historian Wei Xiang, who was writing during the Tang Dynasty, he's the one who dedicated those four pages to her in his History of the Su Dynasty, which was completed in 636. In his view, she was considered a strong leader with a head for military strategy, but was fundamentally a peacemaker. And what made her so impressive and so interesting to the Han Chinese was that she encouraged her people to embrace elements of Chinese culture and to even intermarry with the Hans like she had. So, according to through one of the sources that I found, during the Northern and Southern Dynasties, the Lingnan area was characterized by turbulence. There were rebellions by government officials and minority leaders more than once. In the 5th and 6th centuries, someone personally led the army to suppress the insurrections over and over, regardless of personal safety. This person was a woman who was an excellent militarist and had exerted great influence on the history of China. The woman is called Lady Xian.
Nice.
What a lovely way to go and talk about her. But anyways, briefly, what is Liang?
Yes.
Or is it Lingnan? I'm going to mess this up. Anyways,
I don't know. Because it's or the Li or something.
But it's a region in the southern part of the Nanling Mountains. And you know how, like, when you look at China, how it has sort of, like, that curved bottom on the western, on, like, the eastern side where, like, the South China Sea is?
Yeah, like its tummy.
Yeah, like its tummy or its bum. It really curves around the base of eastern China and dips down into northern Vietnam.
Yes.
So this is where the Li or the Bayou people lived. And during the second century BCE, the Han Dynasty invaded and basically annexed the region after the Han-Neyu War, which is basically leads to like modern day Guangdong, Guangxi, and northern Vietnam, what it is today.
Yeah.
But basically, is China being here like recent? Is that, you know, they've been there since the second century BCE. They've been there for 700 years at this point.
So, her, yeah, because in the book, they're continually referring to the Chinese people as the colonizers, which is fair. But to your point, it's been 700 years. Would you call them colonizers or would we all just call us Chinese? I mean, it depends on your which side of the thing you're on, I guess.
Well, and another thing, too, is that remember is that the majority of the Han Chinese people had not been moving down below the Yangtze River at that point.
Yeah.
So it's around her time that more of them start to move. They start to go to more settlements there. And then there still are going to go and be hereditary tribal skirmishes. People are going to be fighting all the time.
Yeah.
Lady Xian is also known as the saintly mother of Lingnan, and she was born in the early 5th century in the Lian Dynasty, which ran from 502 to 560, and she died in the early 6th century during the Su Dynasty. She was born as the daughter of the Xian family, which was the leader of the ethnic Li and the other tribes of the Lingnan area for generations, in Guoliang, and she was considered to be one of like their most best leaders that they ever had, even though she never formally claimed power. Apart from being a great leader, Lady Xian was also an excellent militarist. And there's an excerpt from the biography of the Duchess of the Quao State in the Book of Su, which says, quote, roughly, Lady Xian was bright and able since she was a child. When she was living at her parents' home, she was able to pacify the people and soldiers and capable of using the military in a strategic way. And that basically comes from the Book of Su by Wei Xian, which I looked for a copy of online. And so
good luck.
Good freaking luck to me.
You should have emailed Lawrence Yip.
I know. I'm like, hey, Lawrence, I'm trying to go and write about your book, but I do. I went looking for, like, through his sources. We only have like copy of like, an archive, or we know nothing is digital anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just, or again, to his point, everything needs to be translated. So.
And it's like not translating modern day Chinese. It's like translating the equivalent of medieval Chinese.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Anyway. So you need, like, a medieval Chinese linguist.
Exactly.
Good luck.
Okay, but during the Seven-Year War, when the local warlord, Sun Xian, tried to exterminate the ethnic Li, Lady Xian helped her father and brothers plan and direct the campaign, when that's where she really began to show her military ability. Later on in her military life of cracking down on multiple mutinies and killing traitors, the experienced and astute Lady Xian saw through treacherous court officials. She personally went into battle and commanded the whole army, making great military contributions.
Love it.
I know, right? Her military ability was fully reflected in her crusade against the rebel Li Quanxi. In 550, Guizhou Prefecture Governor Li Quanxi occupied an important strategic point, but refused to protect the emperor at risk. In private, Li Quanxi attempted to tempt Feng Bao to send out troops, who was basically like one of the current emperor's major generals at that point. Basically, after examining the situation, Lady Xian saw through the trick, and he decided to go and hold Feng Bao hostage, and he rose in rebellion. She stopped Feng from allying with Li Quanxing, and then Li Quanxing did eventually revolt. And so then, in response, she attacked the dude, and basically, she kind of, like, did what Cleopatra did to the next level. She basically figured out, she's like, okay, they suggested that they attack Li Quanxi's military base directly and lower the enemy's guard. She took the place of Feng Bao and led over 1,000 soldiers to pretend to reward the army with food and drink, and then she launched an attack by surprise and defeated him completely.
So, let me get this right. She was, we were going to attack them head on, but then I'm also going to invite them to dinner so then they think it's cool, come to dinner, but then I'm going to actually attack.
Pretty much what happened was that she was like, I need to go and take them out mm-hmm. because this guy's a major troublemaker.
Yeah.
And so what she did was, is that, okay, sneak attack, gonna trick them. But instead of like inviting them for a banquet, it's literally, let's go and talk to the soldiers themselves. Because who cares if you like take care of the one dude? If he still has a massive army, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, because then another dude can just step in and say, it's my army now. So she said, if I trick them to come over, then it's done. Kind of thing. Is that pretty much how it goes?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. Basically, out of admiration for Lady Xian, Xiao Niudou from the tribe of the Hanin Island came and he then submitted to her.
You know what that is? Because he probably heard about how she did this and said, I don't want any of that, so I'll just surrender preemptively. Please don't hurt.
By the way, it's Hanan. I totally was reading the word. Da, 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 da. Sorry about that. She also then pleaded with the imperial court to set up Yas Ho in Hanan, who was basically one of her associates. Since then, Hanan Island returned to the motherland after being away from the central government for nearly 600 years.
Okay, so for 600 years, China was trying to get this island to come back, and this island is peace out. And then she does her badassery, and that island said, we will surrender to you before you come and do your badassery here, even though it's been 600 years of China saying, we need this island.
Pretty much.
And this island is, you can't make me.
Yeah.
Then this lady shows up, and how the turntables have turned.
Exactly.
Nice.
Yeah. Quote, she lived through three dynasties, namely the Liang dynasty from 502 to 560, the Chen dynasty, the 557 to 589, and the Su dynasty from 581 to 618. That's, remember, we have the north and the south, but we have the inter-dynasties.
Mm-hmm.
She enjoyed a high prestige among the public and had a strong military and economic power. However, she never tried to claim the throne.
Very wise, probably.
Yeah. Instead, she led the Lingnan people to return to the imperial court and spare no effort to put down rebellions and safeguard their home. She had suppressed successfully the rebellion of Li Quanxi and the Liang dynasty, the rebellion of the Ouyang He and the Chen dynasty, and the rebellion of Wang Zongyi and the Su dynasty.
I feel like this lady is like a one-woman sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every single town, it's just, she just rolls up and she's like, there's a new sheriff in town. Pew, pew.
She was described as being impartial and incorruptible, indignantly imprisoning her grandson, Fen Shuang.
Okay, now I relate to this lady. Continue.
Who practiced favoritism and did not fight in war. She also punished Zhao Niao, the head of Fan Xiao, currently Guozhu, a county-level city under the jurisdiction of Mao Ming City, who twisted the law and was corrupt by obtaining bribes. When Lady Xian looked back at her life in an old age, she's reported to have said, and this is probably like one of those Elizabeth, I have the mind of the weak and feeble body of a woman.
But yeah.
Like, we don't...
Quotable quotes.
Anyways.
Quotable quotes. I want to hear it.
Her quotable quote is, I have served the emperors of three dynasties with the same good heart.
I love it. You know what? Is this lady an ESTJ? Because she seems like an ESTJ.
Oh my God.
I'm an ESTJ, by the way. So this lady sounds like me saying, I just care about justice. I don't really care about, you know, oh, this can get you ahead or but. I'm like, nope. Either it's right or it's right.
Yep. Anyway, she died in 602 while she was on tour in Hainan. And just like as a really quick thing, Hainan is not Taiwan. Remember again, like, think about China. They have, like, the small island at the very bottom.
Yeah.
That's Hainan.
Okay.
Taiwan's over near the north.
Yeah, it's another one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just want to be clear.
Fair enough.
So yeah, that was her life. Very, like, high-level overview.
I mean, it's a lot more than probably what we were getting at the back of that historical context in the book. So,
I tried.
Good job, Julia.
Anyways.
I give kudos to you.
So we had, like, big, this is a little bit about China, North and South dynasties, about her. So now, what did you remember of the book?
So it's interesting because, you know what? Now that we've done it sort of in this reverse way, he did a very good job then in terms of her characterization because in this book... So, okay, sorry. What did I first think about this book?
What did you first think about? Like, what do you remember about the book? What did you think about the book?
Okay, so this I remember this book only from the fact of I didn't like it. And you know what? I think it was a combination of a bunch of things where when I first got it, I think I was sort of, I was almost on the cusp of aging out of reading the books. And I would care about it if it was on like a subject or a person or a place that I was very interested in.
Or you already knew about
it. Or I already knew about, like I was already, oh, I want to know more about this. I didn't know, I didn't have any sort of context for China at this time or anything. And so when I started reading it, and that was the whole thing, like in my mind, I was thinking like when we think of, like I was saying, when you think about classic China, I was imagining it to be something like taking place at the Forbidden Palace or one of whatever, you know? So when it's not that, and I was starting to read it, I was just, this is set in China, but you're calling the Chinese people colonizers, and they're almost like your sort of antagonists. Or like, where are you from? Like, what's your story? So I didn't, it was harder for me to get into. So frankly, I can't even remember if I finished the book. That time. It's also very long.
It is.
You know what? Nzinga was woefully short. This book was a little woefully long.
Yeah, like in totality, it's 300 pages. Like that is including, in fairness, the historical background
stuff. Even without historical background, it's like 240-something pages, 270-something pages.
Let's go and look that up. Historical note, Yeah, it's 278 pages.
Yeah, so it's a big book. And this isn't to say like I wasn't a big reader, but there is something about if you're reading about something that you're already sort of the pump is primed for, you could read a forever book on something like that. But anyway, so the point is I didn't have fond memories of it. So it was one of those things where I was like, oh, we have to read this book. And I didn't remember anything positive about it. So that was my thinking about it then, but I reread it and I have different feelings. But what did you remember about this book from back in the day?
I remember reading it and I remember feeling that was a book. I think the thing, like, this is gonna sound like such a cliche thing to say, but I had quite a few kids when I was growing up who were friends of mine whose family were from China.
No, it's not cliche. It's a legit thing.
So I've always been somebody where I like to learn about people's backgrounds. You know, if you have a, if you're of like a different faith or like ethnic background, like I want to learn what I can, not in like a fetishizing gross type of way, but in like a, I want to be able to go and like you understand the context from which you came from and how you understand yourself and be open to learning more about you as a person and where you come from, right?
Which is really how we should approach all relationships, with loving curiosity.
Yeah, so I mean, that was like a big motivation for me in reading this.
Maybe something that connects with some of my people.
But it did not.
It did not.
Because most of my friends were from the north.
Oh.
And then it wasn't until I was in university where it's like, you know, I'm from Hunan, or it's, yeah, I'm from Hong Kong, or it's like, well, I'm from Shanghai, but I've lived there since I was 9.
Yeah.
So it's a very different.
A very different experience.
But even in that, those free examples within that friend group, that was when it was a, you know, like I intellectually knew that China was super diverse in experience. It's a massive country.
Yes.
In the same way that people from like BC are not the same way as people who are from Quebec or people in the southern United States, etc.
Yeah.
Like I knew that. But chilling with my friends and being like, oh, we have radically different cultural experiences in some ways. Yeah, because they're all from three very different locations.
It's not as homogenized as we've been led to believe.
Exactly. That racist stereotype of what it means to be Chinese doesn't actually exist. But anyways, that's another conversation.
That's another story.
But anyway, so that was my interest in wanting to read the book. And then I think I definitely liked it more. There were some artistic license choices that he made. I don't really like know why you're doing this, but I can kind of get it too. He went and he did his best to get the information about this person. Well, I think to your point, he kept with her characterization very much in how she's reflected and commemorated now.
Yeah, I feel like he almost had 4 bullet point facts because of the limited information. Yep. And then he was able to really parse out from those 4 bullet points a really fulsome picture of who this person person could have been. Mm-hmm. Now, it's different, though, as opposed to, you know, if someone's really documented, then you can make it super accurate in terms of their personality and, like, their likes or dislikes or whatever. Where they,
we know, for example, which palace Elizabeth I was at the time because we have court records and stuff like that.
Yeah, and so you can sort of piece it together. So, and at the same time, have, like, a difficult job trying to show what is the difference between these different ethnic groups that live mm-hmm. in China and how, what are their different home situations like and what's the role of women and what's the role of men and the fashion and like, so he had a lot to try to explain because mm-hmm. instead of just talking about one person at a time, she's doing this thing where her father sends her to get educated
yep.
in a Chinese, quote unquote, Chinese context. It's all China, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. A Han China context.
So he's really had to do a lot where he has to sort of dual explain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unlike where in Nzinga, how she's encountering just one Portuguese person.
Yeah.
And like, she does go and liaise with them. But Patricia McKissick doesn't sit down and say, let me explain about what Portuguese people are like and blah, blah,
mm-hmm,
blah.
Mm-hmm,
because there is that underpinning assumption of you're probably white reading this. You probably have a vague idea about Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to get into how's their home set up or what kind of clothes are they wearing or
yeah.
what do they look like? Because you know.
Yeah.
So in this context, he's...
Or it's not... And her, she made the choice, like, this isn't very relevant to me. I want to keep Nzinga and her people as the main
thing. The focus.
Which, total respect for doing that.
Which is good. And so, but I think in this book, he was sort of having to double lift, where he's mm-hmm. like, I'm not just explaining about this southern tribe of people, I'm also explaining more about that imperial Han China mm-hmm. remnant.
Yeah.
That's still hanging around.
Exactly.
All the interplay that comes in with the different tribes trying to band together, and there's the Doghead people, which, question mark, who are the Doghead people? This weird tribe, but they also have access to elephants, so I'm like, maybe they're Vietnamese?
I don't know. I mean, when he said Doghead, I just thought about Pathologic and the weird children's game.
Get out of here with your video games.
My weird Russian video games?
Yes.
Everyone, go and play Pathologic
too.
Don't
listen to her. Stop
yes,
it.
Listen to me.
Oh,
anyways. Leave that in.
I will. Okay.
Point is...
So, essentially, though, what you said about her as a real historical person, that whole thing about strategy and being strategic, I appreciate how that came up in the book multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wasn't just a one-off, a fluke thing. You can see how she assesses what the situation is, recognizes who are the people that need her help, or mm-hmm. even interpersonally, how when she's in this other family and
yep.
she recognizes the daughter's hostility towards her isn't because she's, you know, prejudiced against her. It's really coming from a place of jealousy because she's shown up and she's a better student than they are.
Yeah.
And the mother likes her more.
Yeah,
and
personality-wise, all that. And also she's shiny and she's new and
yeah.
she's something exotic.
That too.
Yeah.
So I appreciated, though, how if you're going to be showing someone to be a strategic thinker doesn't just do it once. Amazing. They had strategy. They showed that acumen throughout things, not just when it's a big battle-y thing.
Well, and also, too, is that I really liked how at the very beginning, there's a really simple one of the guy's chicken ate some grain or whatever. It's just, well, go and give her some eggs. Oh my God, I can't believe you fought about that. But for her, it's just so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things where, to your point, right, is not even just that she is a strategic thinker and he really has a strong understanding of her characterization, but literally how she develops in her thinking as a person. And she goes, oh, it's maybe might be intuitive to me, but I need to be aware of it as well. Like, how do I go and come to these realizations?
Well, the other big component of becoming a strategic, not just thinker, but leader is just because I thought of this amazing idea, how do I convey it in a way that works for the person who will actually end up executing it? So, like,
how do I get buy-in?
How do I get that buy-in? So I think that's where for...
Strategic Thinking with Felicia and Julia.
I know. This is like a segue podcast now.
I know, right?
I'm like, check us out on LinkedIn Learning. No. So essentially, yeah, it's a very simple plot, you know, in terms of, you know, that she's being trained or she's being singled out again. You know, it's like the same thing with Nzinga. She's being singled handle that again over the other children or the other kids or the future king, essentially.
Well, once again, we have mediocre brother alert.
Yeah, we have mediocre stinker brother alert who finally gets his act together enough to realize she knows what she's doing better than I do. Maybe I should just shut up and listen to her.
Which is a wild but amazing concept.
What a concept. Stop being mediocre. Or if you can't not help but be mediocre, let someone else have a chance to step up.
Yep.
Anyways, so the father decides for diplomatic reasons and then also for future preservation reasons, you really should get educated from these Han Chinese people. Mm-hmm. So she learns how to write. She learns their customs. So that was the whole thing, too. She becomes like a cultural liaison mm-hmm. between more tribal type of people versus more codified Han Chinese people.
Well, and she did that in real life, too, right?
Exactly.
That was really important to her. I think one thing is that she probably recognized that we are the minority and that although we don't want to necessarily lose our culture, if we can go and understand and have better communication at minimum, or at least more avenues of connection with these people, aside from you now happen to live here.
Yes.
You might have a more productive relationship.
Yeah. And a better chance of probably trying to preserve your people and culture mm-hmm. than, you know, obstinately standing against it and then just getting crushed in whatever battle that there is going to happen.
Exactly.
But then what happens is like warring factions of tribes. And then you have like those doghead people. Who are they? Question marks.
If anybody knows who the doghead people are, we both read this book. We cannot yet figure it out.
Who are these doghead people? But I also don't want to do like a whole summarization of the book. Because frankly, that's not what we're here for.
No.
You know what it was? There was quite a bit of stuff in there that, you know, that's nice. But do I need this for the plot?
I think also too, is I think like most men, full offense to all men, they don't really know how to write in the voice of a young woman or a teenage girl that well.
Well, and I mean, that was especially obvious where at the end, so she's like a 15-year-old girl, probably 16.
By the end, yeah, about she's to be like 17.
Yeah. So she meets the guy who's going to become her future husband. She just doesn't know it yet.
Yeah.
And it's really cute, actually, how they, like, bond over their love of books. And, you know, he's a soldier. And she's a
warrior poet.
I know. And she says, you know, something along the lines about, oh, are you just here for the books and blah, blah, blah. He says, yeah, I was always reading. My dad would get angry that I wanted to go to school and he wanted me to be sword fighting. And she's just like, oh. Mm-hmm. But she, as a character, doesn't clue in that she has a crush, and everybody else sort of clues in that she has a crush. And I'm thinking, hashtag not relatable. No. This is speaking from someone who had very severe crushes at a very young age. So part of me is just, Lawrence, she knew she had a crush on the dude.
Yes.
It's okay to show that. So anyways.
I think also there's the point where he does explain some stuff, give context and everything like that, but even at the very beginning where it's a, oh no, Spring Festival is going to be canceled. Wait a second, what's Spring Festival? Oh, it's New Year. I was like, that makes so much more sense now.
Yeah. Just little things like that.
Or even how it took me a moment or two to actually even go and figure out the location when they said South China.
Yeah, where in South China?
That is very, very big.
Hence why I'm trying to, you know, sort of weird MacGyver an answer out of it. You know, the dog people, and they have elephants. So I'm like, well, who has elephants? Asian elephants? Where? And I'm Googling, where are Asian elephants?
Yeah.
Around this time, too. Well, and I think that is another thing, too, is because they're in a very tropical region. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was very heavily forested.
Yeah.
So the landscape that's there now
is not what it is.
This book, I'm very neutral. Where are you on the scale? Like chaotic, evil, you know, and all that stuff. I'm like,
true neutral.
True neutral.
I mean, I think one thing, too, is that I'm glad that we have this book.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it's always important that we remember that not all royalty is from Europe.
Yeah.
But I also think, too, I'm like, man, I wish that we had more of the famous women in Chinese history that could have been one of our people.
Well, and I mean, I was thinking about that because there are quite a few actual famous women who became, like, empresses.
Well, they were dowager empress because there's only ever been one woman who ruled in her own right, Wu Zetian. And she was the one woman who ruled during the later Tang Dynasty. And she's the only, like, empress regent ever. The only female emperor in the entire history of China.
Who ruled independently.
Yes.
Isn't she the inspo for Empress of China?
I don't know. I've never watched Empress of China.
How could you have not watched Empress of China?
Because you were watching Empress of China and I was watching Magnificent Century.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So what are your final thoughts about this book and what you've learned today?
You know what? I will say this. Two things. One, I'm glad that I was able to reread this book mm-hmm. with a better attention span mm-hmm. and almost more knowledge base so that I actually had a little bit more context than I was when this book first came out. Because when this book first came out, I had like zero context.
Yep.
So it was very difficult for me. Mm-hmm. Now, not so much. Then two, because we've read this book in the context of doing this project, mm-hmm. I think is great in terms of getting a very, even though it was high level, it was nice to get some sort of overview about that time period in China and what was happening with the different peoples and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I feel positive about this book and this experience.
So no longer neutral, but positive.
Yeah. More than just neutral. I would say it was just neutral about the book in terms of how it was written.
Yeah.
And overall, how it was handled. Would I have preferred it to be a bit more of the interior life of a young woman who's sort of being pulled between that dual identity, yeah. which gets touched on very briefly, but really could have been a little bit more of a thing.
And I think also, too, is like on one hand, I understand why Lawrence Yip might have not wanted to go there because, I mean, he even goes and talks about being Chinese American and having that dual identity being pulled between cultures and experiences.
Which is why he picked her, he said.
Exactly. So I wish that he had leaned into that a bit more, but I can also understand why personally he's like, I just can't be that vulnerable at that moment. And I totally respect that.
Which is fine. That's his writing choice. So, yeah. So what are your final thoughts on this book?
I enjoyed it much more this time around. It really made me have a different appreciation, too, for, like, Southern Chinese history and culture. I'm really hoping to go to China within the next 2 years on, like, a really fun trip with my friends. And I'm definitely going to go and make them go to Lady Xian's temple. And they'll be like, why are we here? I'm like, listen, fam.
You're like, let me tell you about the tale of the Lady of Chaohu.
Exactly. I'm really looking forward to that.
Awesome.
It's going to be great.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.